I visited most of the United States. I think Hawaii, Alaska, Iowa, which is where you're from, Cody.
Iowa. Yeah.
Do you remember Iowa, or did you leave at an early age?
My first two memories are in Iowa. Yeah. I remember like a flood, putting my toes in like some black water. And I asked my mom what that was. She said we had like a flood in the basement or something. And then this one's kind of dark, but my mom and me, my brother, were walking on a runway. It's raining. We're getting on a plane. We're going to try to go find my dad. And that was also in Iowa. Yeah.
When you say you're trying to find your dad, like
he moved to Colorado and then just kind of like wasn't coming back or something. I never really got the full story. I suppose I could ask him, but
that's the start of your life.
Yeah. So we basically, my mom and us, we go track him down. You know, I would imagine it wasn't too hard, right? Like, but we go out there and then move to Colorado. Yeah.
So you have these vague memories of Iowa. You go to Colorado in the search of this father, you know?
Yeah.
God damn, that's...
I don't know exactly what he was doing out there. I think he was painting with one of my uncles or something like that. Just like needed work.
Irish. Is that your background?
Yeah, Irish and German.
Irish and German. Oh, yeah. God, cold and emotional.
Yeah.
That's a bit of everything. On what side is your Irish part?
My mom's side is Irish, and then my dad's side is Irish and German.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This cultural thing about Irish people, basically the whitest Mexicans you'll ever meet, right? Irish people.
That's right. I read somewhere that like the Irish came and there was like an Irish brigade that fought down here or something like that.
El Batallón de San Patricio, the Battalion of St. Patrick, is legendary in Mexico. Basically, the last Mexican-American war, they brought a whole battalion of Irish. And they were, the Irish were like, yeah, man, things are bad. Things are way cooler down here.
Yeah.
So they had monuments and stuff like that to them. They basically committed treason and joined the Mexicans.
Joined the Mexicans, yeah.
Because, you know, Catholics, man, you know, don't trust the Catholics.
Yeah. That's cool though.
Yeah. I've met many people who are of Irish descent in the United States. And sometimes as I learn about the culture and stuff like that, I make the mistake thinking that everybody that's white is Protestant or has some sort of Protestant background. But it's like, oh, you guys have alcoholism too. You guys get rowdy at bars too as well.
I mean, there are all the negative stereotypes about the Irish probably exist in my family or like as a young version of me. Like I was that. I was just a rowdy, you know.
I mean... Look, this nose. I wasn't an MMA fighter.
Yeah,
I was just an idiot that would get drunk and would think I was invincible. But culturally, it's always the negativity is there. Like some of those negative aspects of being Catholic and being taught that you were born in sin and all this guilt aspect of it. This relishing of in Spanish, we have this term that I heard in a song from this singer, Manu Chao, called malegría. Malegría is basically, bad happiness. Mm. This enjoyment of sorrow, you know. And I hear this in Irish music, and I hear this in Irish celebration, where they're like, you know, you can see fuckers crying, but also smiling and laughing as they're getting drunk over some melancholic memory of something that is unobtainable. I guess.
Yeah.
And that's what you hear when you hear these mariachis kind of singing out, you know. I had the experience of going to an Irish wake, and it was the most Mexican experience that I've had with a bunch of white people. It was wild.
Yeah.
I think there's a weird separation that culturally the United States has to death. I mean, most funerals that I've gone to in the U.S., have a memorial video being played on a screen.
Yeah.
You have a wake with a box and it's glass and there's no touching the body. And it's kind of like detached. Like your person dies, he gets taken, and the next time you see him, they're in a box and there's completely no.
Yeah.
There's something about that really takes away a lot from the process of grieving versus going to an Irish wake. the celebration, the food, seeing people pile in, many people utilizing physical contact to comfort you and like, hey, we're like, dude. And also like how you say goodbye to a body.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say you can touch my body as much as you want when I die.
You're going to be thrown into the incinerator probably. But like it's, I don't know. There's something about having a contact with death that yeah. is missing in the culture.
Did you ever read the book On Killing?
Yeah. Yeah. I met that guy, the guy that wrote it. Yeah.
It's an intense book. It's hard to get through, but it's, it's long. But he gets into some of that, like how the invention of the bedroom, you know, the separation, grandma gets sick, you put her in the other room, now you don't see it anymore. And just like, you know, he's got some pretty deep ideas on that.
Yeah. I mean, Mexicans invented carpooling, you know, so like, or you have multiple generations living in a single house, which is historically, that's how it used to be.
Yeah. Yeah, bro.
And the whole aspect of sending your parents off to a old folks home or sending your sick away, that whole aspect is a very Western aspect. It's not that prevalent in some of the culture that I came up in. And I don't know. It's not saying one is superior toward the other, but there is something about that lack of being present and having like experiencing grief or death directly as some of our ancestors did. And there's something about that, you know, it's not Catholicism, I think. Because, yeah, Irish people, Catholic, Mexican people, Catholic.
Yeah.
But Irish people have a lot of paganism also going on in them, just like Mexicans.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I think both of those cultures were converted to Catholicism, right? And they had all their own ideas and their old monsters and all that stuff beforehand. It doesn't just go away.
Yeah, the parallels that I see, and like both of you are kind of, we nerd out on this supernatural aspect. Like, you're wearing a BPRD t-shirt, which we're going to talk about.
That's right.
If you don't know what BPRD is, you need to be cooler, I guess. Get out more. There's parallels. You have the Irish believe in this wailing woman, this banshee spirit, and in Mexico we have kind of the same thing. There's always this concept of La Llorona. A crier, this woman that just wails because she drowned her children in the river. You know, these monsters, like these archetypes. You guys have leprechauns. We have chaneques, these small things that will fucking run into the forest and fuck with your shit if you don't show respect or if you don't feed them. So, like, it's pretty interesting to see all these parallels. And the similarity between Ireland and Mexico is we were converted, but we did a pretty good job of keeping some of our shit from the past. You know, we kept some of those, I don't know, the cultural memories of some of the paganist aspects of who we were before.
Yeah.
That's why Catholicism in Mexico gets like, they're like, what the fuck is this? When people from the outside come here.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just a different thing.
My wife is Vietnamese, and I look at Vietnamese Catholicism, and it's its own thing, bro.
Yeah.
You know, like we will go to little services here and there for family stuff, and it's intense, bro. Like, yeah. I can't even really say that I've seen them pray to God. They pray to their ancestors all the time.
Yeah.
You know, but
I mean, that's the aspect of what they're carrying forth from whatever they had before.
Yeah.
Like, here we have Day of the Dead.
Yeah,
which people think it's native. It's not. It Day of the Dead comes from a nationalistic movement in the 50s. They're like, hey, we need to make our own celebrations. So they came up with Day of the Dead and put a bunch of celebrations of the dead in a single month and a single day. But it is very much ancestor worship, if you kind of look at it directly. And that's what we had before we had this vision of this crucified man and this virgin, you know?
Yeah.
We just had the celebration of the Virgen de Guadalupe, which people would say, oh, that's the Virgin Mary, but she's brown, she's wearing Aztec regalia. You know, there's a war god lifting her up with these eagle wings. So, when you go and see the basilica where the Virgen de Guadalupe is, that used to be the site where the temple of the goddess Tonantzin was. So they basically just switched.
Cleaned it up.
Is that in Mexico City where we went?
Yeah, that grotto that we saw. Yeah.
There was a pyramid or something there. You said
not a pyramid. It was a temple.
That's
the temple of Coatlicue, or Donatzin, the mother goddess of the Aztec Empire. And a reason why the Catholics kind of had like a good time or easy time of absorbing all these cultures is they were like, well, we have this virgin that gave birth to God. And we have something like that too. So the Aztecs believed that there was this mother goddess that found a feather on the ground and put it in her robes. And then she became pregnant. Mm-hmm. And her other kids were like, hey, we're the only kids you should have. So we're going to attack you. And out comes a fully armored, miraculously born war god, Huitzilopochtli, and fights them off and cuts the sister into pieces and puts her on the moon. And then the rest of them get spread out in the stars, that the ones that were fighting against her. So that's the origin of it. So you see that and, oh, it matches up with this virgin that had this immaculate conception. So yep. Let's just go with it.
I think that happened all over the world, though, as Christianity was spreading. You can look at all, you know, a lot of the Germanic, like pagan holidays, they all lined up and all that. Yeah, you know,
going to
converting people to a new idea is, I would imagine that's, yeah, you know.
Going to Switzerland.
Business.
And seeing the Catholicism there. It's like, I don't know, it's like streamlined Catholicism.
They had some weird stuff on their, they had on the outside of their church, there was like a king with like, devils, dogs, or something.
Yeah, there's a lot of royalty attached to the Catholicism in Europe.
Yeah,
which is weird here because we don't fuck around with the royalty here, so, yeah. That's not present. You went to Denver. Denver is a rowdy place. It's always been a rowdy place, I think. Did you grow up in Denver?
Yeah, I grew up in the suburbs, you know, neighborhood outside of Denver called Aurora.
Did you experience its change? Because Denver changed over the years. It turned into a weird place.
Yeah, I mean, it's, dude, especially a lot lately, right? Yeah. Like the last couple of years has been pretty intense. Denver's a weird, I don't really like it anymore, if I'm being honest, you know? If I didn't have so much going on there with business and stuff like that, I'd probably go somewhere else.
What was Denver when you were growing up? Was it boring? Was it just like?
It was pretty cool, man. I mean, where I lived, there was a bunch of Korean kids. I remember that. Like, there was like maybe like an exchange program or something, because there's probably like 20 Korean families in my neighborhood. We had fun, man. We were riding bikes, and I was in that generation where like our parents wouldn't let us in the house. Like, they legit like wouldn't let us in the house. Like, go outside. You can come back when the streetlights turn on or something. So. We just figured it out, riding bikes and getting into trouble and, dodging bullies and stuff. There was a lot of bullies when I was young. I was the oldest, so.
What happened to them? Where are they now?
I don't know.
They got canceled, right?
Yeah, man. You know, I don't know. Who knows? You know.
I'm not in favor of bullying, but I am who I am because I had a lot of a shit ton of people beat the shit out of me.
Yeah, me too, bro. me too. I got my ass whooped, bro. And then, you know. Eventually, I kicked their asses, and that's kind of how it went, you know?
This experience, like, it's a formative thing. And I recently had my experience with my daughter. She's 12, and she had a bully 2 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And in my mind, I'm like, I could hip toss that kid. So I don't know. Like,
yeah.
But that's, you know, that's not the way, or is it?
Why? Wait, what do you mean it's not the way?
Well, it was verbal bullying. So basically what I said is, okay, you need to come up with some verbal jujitsu.
Yeah.
If she's shit talking, you need to be better about it. If she is spreading false information or lies, I read a bunch of books on I'm a single dad raising a daughter. So I had to like figure some things out because I didn't grow up like that, you know? So I realized that a lot of the bullying that females will experience, it's not going to be physical.
It's like that social bull. They're such social creatures. You know?
So I had to like sit down with her and, you know, show her how to shit talk and figure out what to do with like hearsay and gossip. And also realizing that some of these kids have a very mature way of being vicious.
Yeah.
That they learn either at home or this whole toxic, in Mexico, we call them toxicas. Which is like a celebrated thing. Oh, your kid's toxica. She has an attitude. She's sassy. She's kind of mature for her age, which is celebrated. But it's, dude, it's not a good thing.
He's definitely an expert though at it now.
Oh yeah. I can't talk about exactly.
Nobody.
She's
an expert at shit talking.
I mean.
He's good. He's good.
There was a kid being horrible to her. A boy.
Oh, are you going to say the latest one?
Yeah.
Oh, this is the best.
Every now and then when I'm with my kid, I just come up with nicknames for her. She'll throw some at me and we just do this and it's funny. This kid was being horrible to mine.
Wait, are you sure you can say this? Cause,
yeah, fuck it.
Okay.
One of the kids starts like being, and my daughter just nonchalantly, she's like, oh, you're a stupid head. And my kid, well, you're very emotional, it seems. And I think your name should be changed, you know, instead of Emmanuel, I'm going to start calling you Emmanuel, you know, Emmanuel, like an emo.
Yeah.
And dude, that caught on.
And like, all the other kids started calling him that too.
And then I got a call from school, but,
that's good.
Yeah. But experiencing the type of bullying that we're talking about as kids, this whole aspect of I'm bigger than you.
Yeah.
You have shitty shoes, you know, you look weird. Where's it like your family's different? You know, that's, I don't know. I mean, it's still around, I think, but you know, back then I think about it now, having a dad that would like, hey, don't do that to my kid. Probably wouldn't fucking help me realistically. I mean, it wouldn't have given me that strength of character, I think, that I got from like having to confront some of these pieces of shit kids.
Yeah.
And some of them later turn into friends once you beat the shit out of them.
Yeah, I think you got to give them the tools.
Yeah.
I think you can, like, we just had an incident the other day and my wife went down to the school and handled it. But I don't think it was enough for my son to get physical, but I think you should give him the tools in case.
Do you, I know you're involved with like a Gracie program. Do you guys do the 3 T's? For bullying? Are you familiar with that?
I don't think I've ever taught that or...
So they do it in like the... This is... It's worthwhile. They do it in their youth program, but it's talk, tell, tackle. So first thing that your kid's supposed to do is actually, you know, confront the bully verbally and be like, yo, like, stop fucking with me. What you're doing is not okay, that kind of thing. And then they go for backup so they can tell an adult like, yo, I talked to this dude already once. I need you to talk to him because I'm about to whoop his ass, you know, something like that. And then if it keeps happening, then the kids, you know, tackle the problem. My daughter used it. It worked.
I think I kind of taught that not knowing, actually.
Yeah. No, I didn't. I told her like if somebody's physical, you just punch.
Oh, yeah. Physical, you go straight to it.
Yeah. If they're physical, right to it.
It's right to it.
This is like verbal bullying.
Yeah.
You know, if they're like giving your kid a hard time.
I had no such training and I stabbed the dude with a fucking pencil once he was talking shit about me. But in the hand, that dude, that got me.
Did he get lead poisoning?
No, but it
did. Do you get lead poisoning from pencils?
No, but it got me a few marks on my hand from the nuns.
Dude, you want to hear some listen to this crazy shit. So I'm in first grade or kindergarten and I make, you know, how you used to make like, you'd make something out of clay and then they'd put it in like the kiln and it gets hard and you paint it and take it home. Right. So I make a stegosaurus and I'm like super excited about this thing. My mom, I was a mama's boy and I just like lived for my mom's praise. Right. So I made this stegosaurus and she was going to be like, oh my God, you know, you're so talented or whatever. I'm really excited to bring this thing home, but I'm getting picked on the way home. And I forget that this stegosaurus is in my backpack and I swing my backpack at this kid and crack him in the head.
Oh, shit.
Fucking rock.
Yeah. With this like super hard stegosaurus. He gets a cut on his head. You know, I get in big trouble. I come home and I'm trying to hide the dinosaur. I'm like, I don't know what it was. There was nothing in my backpack, you know? So then I get busted for lying. And then my dad takes the dinosaur and they're like yelling at me and he snaps its head. Wow. And I was like, oh. Yeah. But imagine if a kid did that nowadays, I would have been in so much trouble.
Yeah.
Smacking somebody in the head.
The news.
Yeah, dude.
Fucking end up in the news or like some sort of fucking record being done.
Yeah.
Did you fix the stegosaurus?
Yeah, my mom glued the head back on.
Fuck yeah.
Hell yeah.
Fuck yeah, good mom.
Yeah, she glued the head back on.
Do you still have it?
If we did for a while. I don't know what it is now. Shit. I wish I had it.
If you still have it, find a picture.
Yeah. That's the thing. Like, well, I went through so much shit in my life that I lost most things. Like, I have a few.
Yeah.
Like a box, like a small box of things. Like, I have a plate that my mom used to feed me when I was a kid. You know, my mom's necklace, her knife that I based the knife design of the Elvion.
That now we all have.
Dude. I had no idea how valuable that thing that you left me, but I don't have a lot of stuff though. Like a lot of it just, you know, was lost. The, you know, violence and the kind of the formative years of violence when you're young. I've noticed that a lot of people that grow up and then turn into professional fighters or that go into the realms of violence, whatever they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, there are differences picking up a rifle and going off and shooting people. But in the end, it's all going into a place where you're going to be tested physically. I think that's kind of the, that's the orientation that a lot of us get when we're kids. I mean, I grew up watching Commando and Rambo and fucking all these violent ass movies. And I'm like, maybe one day, but never in my wildest dreams when I was a kid, did I dream, I want to be a cop.
Yeah.
Specifically not in Mexico. Fuck that. Right. But violence was a thing, and I started getting into it, right? Specifically for me, it was, if you get tested by somebody and you submit, that's going to happen more and more from other people and not just that same one.
That's right.
And I had no, I have a, my dad is, was in the picture. He's a cool guy, not a fighter. He's a lover.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
No, like in the backyard, teach me how to fight. My mom, on the other hand, she was a fucking murderous ninja. And, but she didn't like, there's no way that she can show me how to kind of confront male violence. But it started showing up for me in, you know, people testing, you know, fist fights, larger kids trying to get the better of a smaller one.
Yeah.
And also just being in a fucking Catholic school setting where this, it's just, you can't do anything or else you're going to get fucking physically beat. So you knew the consequences were there and you didn't any. So this weird masochist fucking thing happens in your head. What's your first experience with violence and can you tell if there's anything in your past or in your, when you were a kid that led you down this road?
Yeah, for sure, dude. Like, I was a mama's boy, you know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Like I'm not trying to expose, I have three kids. I'm not trying to expose them to how fucked up the world is. I'm not talking to them about, you know, work. Like I was telling you earlier, working at the hospital and stuff. They don't need to know that stuff. But also if you're completely unprepared, like, I mean, I must've looked like fresh meat walking into elementary school. Cause you can just spot that kid. Like I was innocent, you know, and those kids that maybe they have a little bit rougher house or they're exposed to more grown up things, they see an innocent kid like that. And I was just prey, you know? So the first, you know, the beginning is like getting punched in the belly, getting slapped in the face, getting choked and slammed against a wall, like, you know, stuff like that. I remember there was this girl, her name was Natasha Boucher. And I had, oh man, I was like in love with this girl. I'm in first grade. And I'm walking with her and I'm like connecting with her, you know, whatever. And these bullies like turn the corner right at that time and they punk me like right in front of her and they make me cry. And then to top it off, it's like after school. So my mom runs up, you know, to like rescue me. It just couldn't have gone worse, dude. Worse. My mom rescued me, you know, and just felt. Yeah, you walk away from something like that, you just feel awful, you know?
When you say you feel awful, and for me it was, I'm not safe, let me figure out a way to be safer.
Yeah.
There was a moment in my life when I was like, the switch was, I need to figure out how to be safe. Click.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in therapy, I've learned that in those experiences, I created a fragment of my personality. I call it the guard dog. Right. And I think the guard dog came online back then and started, you know, he's like, oh, that's dangerous. Nobody's going to protect little Cody. I'm going to protect little Cody. And maybe he came on real small then, but he grew fast.
A mask.
Yeah, he grew fast, you know.
I like to call it a mask. Like, we develop a mask for ourselves to I don't know, like, if you could, I tell people this, like, oh, man, you had a pretty wild life and all this shit. It's pretty interesting. And I don't like any of it. I don't like some of it. It was like fucking horrible.
Yeah.
And there is an aspect of this is dissociation with violence that I've managed to kind of figure for myself out now.
Yeah.
Where, like you say, like something takes over. And it's not like, it wasn't me. Something took over. No, it's like you yourself make this mask or this persona. Like, hey, I'm afraid. Like, I'm not into this shit. But I have to do this. So let me just be horrible at it, I guess.
Yes. And then it gets exciting, you know? And then, and that's kind of part of the problem. Yeah. I remember the first time that I like really stood up to bullies and fought, won even, you know, then the attention that comes from that is probably not a good thing.
The celebration, the jubilation when you knock somebody on.
Yeah, man. And all of a sudden now you're some kind of like, I don't know.
You matter now.
Mm-hmm.
Like I remember seeing a kid do that once and how it socially it changed for him,
yep.
You know, and some people get hooked on that, I guess. Specifically if you grew up in a household or in an environment where there's no celebrations of you, and then all of a sudden you're getting celebrated by all your fucking kids after you knock somebody out.
Yeah. I mean, in my house, I think, you know, I'm not trying to like rag on my dad, but I don't think my dad ever celebrated me, you know, and he was there, but he wasn't giving me what I needed, you know, and then maybe my mom was kind of smothering me with the wrong kind of energy, you know? So like, there was this like, I wanted to be tough. I wanted to be all the heroes I saw on TV, you know what I mean? I wanted to be the hero in my story.
And you know, like fast forward and now you have a family, you know?
Yeah.
And you, who better than you to know on the holes?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? I mean, every now and then I see people that have families and like, yeah, dude, your kid's been on the tablet for like 5 hours. Like, do something about that, right? What's going on there?
Yeah.
And they're not present in that kid's life. Yeah. You know, there's no, been in there like, and then you're like, oh, it's because you grew up well.
Yeah.
And that's why you're just not, yeah, there's no effort there. There's
you don't have all this trauma.
There's no stakes there.
Dude, that's awesome. Because I literally feel like anything that I'm good at, I'm only good at it because I did it the wrong way or experienced it the wrong way, or you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, yeah.
It was super interesting.
I mean, at the end of all that shit, for me at least, when you go through all that therapy, try to figure out all like how messed up you are, you realize how essential all that is. You know, I remember hearing this from somebody in a group therapy session, you know? Like I remember somebody's talked about this horrific experience that they had in their life, which is, I highly recommend anybody that's going through some bullshit that went through some bullshit to go through group therapy sessions and just listen to other people's fucking hell. This guy goes through this story about how he was well off, you know, had all this fucking money. He's about to marry the love of his life. And then he gets in a car accident and he breaks multiple bones in his body. Part of the head injury he has got basically gave him ADHD overnight in a lot of ways, you know? So all that focus went away and all this shit went away.
Now he's like us.
Yeah. Now he has the superpowers.
Yeah.
And like, he's going through all this, like, the chick left, you know, his fiance left, the business went under, he was robbed at his house and he couldn't do anything about it because of his condition. All of the riff shit. And I'm like, most of us are bawling our eyes out in this fucking room, like, listening to him. And at the end of that, he says, and one of the nurses that was taking care of me is now my wife. And then he pulls out some pictures of his kids. He just made these three beautiful daughters, right? And then he tells us about his startup company that he sold. And now he like all this, like, and like, dude, your fucking life is amazing. Yeah. And he said, all of that bullshit that I had to go through was essential to the plot.
Right.
It's essential. There's no way.
And what do you think about that? Because I think about that a lot. I think about any time that something that you could perceive as great at the beginning, like let's say you give me a cupcake, right? Give me a cupcake. Oh, that looks fucking awesome, right? It's sweet. It's going to give me diabetes. It's going to give me all these problems. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I try to find those cupcakes in life. I'm like, yeah, it's way fucking too good to be true. Right. That's the devil. You know what I'm saying? Like the devil gives you something that tastes good. Right. And I over and over and over again, when I get a plate that doesn't have a cupcake on it, it's got like a dog turd on it. It's got something where I'm just like, dude, I don't want that. And I perceive it as this dark, horrible thing. But now I'm at this place where like, you literally hand me that plate with the turd on it. And I'm like looking up. I'm like, thank you, God. Cause I know that from that comes like everything good in my life comes from something that in the beginning looks like shit, you know?
I guess a lot of us live in denial on that aspect. Like, hey, all you have to do is just play it straight, be good, and nothing bad is going to happen.
You don't want that.
That's bullshit.
Yeah. And you don't
want a lot of bad things will happen. Yeah. Don't take any risk. Don't take any fucking risk in your life and see where that takes you. Or people fall into the trap of feeling special with what happened to them. Yeah. Like, hey, this happened to me and like God has it in for me and like all that shit. Dude, everybody has a fucking, all life, all of it. Every single person that you know, everybody that you meet out there in the street, unless they're living in a bubble, and if they are living in a bubble, that's their tragedy. Everything ends in tragedy. Everything. Yeah. And what really matters is, you know, those moments of jubilation and celebration that you have along the way, you know, which is maybe corny to listen to, but like Eddie and me had a moment recently, you know, me and Eddie took our kids to Europe, which might seem like not a big thing for other people, but I grew up in the third world, poor as fuck. And I'm taking my kid at 12 to be on stepping on top of the Alps.
Yep.
While only 10 years ago, I was trying to revive a midget inside of a pool somewhere because I had a Christmas party for a bunch of cops in Mexico. Right. So, but I realized that in that moment, like there's, how can you get to that moment of like high jubilation with your kid just fucking having a snowball fight on top of the Alps while only a few years ago, you were like trying to, you know, pick up one of your friends who just got shot in the face and take him to the hospital when you know there's nothing that could be done about it. And somehow both of these things are related. You know, that's like, I guess for me,
I believe they are. Yeah, I believe they are.
Yeah, they have to be. And you know, that kind of leads into this whole like, fuck, you know, like this denial and avoidance of things. And I mean, some the necessary evils of the world, you know.
Yeah, bro. I mean, personally, I recently had like a dark chapter, like six, seven weeks of like, you know, I had this diagnosis and then I'm waiting for all these tests. And I mean, it's just like, you know, maybe you get your 10 days in between tests or something. Right. But during those 10 days, your mind can go to some fucking places, you know, dark places. Right. But when you get to the other side of it, it's like, what if that was the point? What if the point was like the dark places? What if the point was like, you know, if I'm going to graduate to this next thing, if I'm going to add this level of like sage energy to me, what if I don't get it without, you know, I don't think you get the good stuff without the bad stuff.
Yeah.
Or it wouldn't be good.
Nope.
Wouldn't be worth it.
Nope. Tell me a trust fund baby and I'll tell you a very damaged and fucking tortured mind.
It's somebody that I don't want to hang out with.
I've met some of them and they're like, why are you fascinated with my life? Because you fucking did shit and stuff like that. Oh. And then I'm like, what am I bitching about then? You know, this aspect when you go there. And like, speaking of doing wild shit in life, you went into fighting. But before you went into fighting, like I was kind of researching a little bit about you, you for a time while you were, I think you were studying the arts,
yep.
arts and design.
Yep.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, I was an art student.
Which is, because I, the whole aspect, like, art, really? Yeah, creative thing. I like art. That's the, oh, I love that. When I was like growing up, it was like a way to escape, I guess, for me. You were doing some work at a psychiatric facility.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. This is before your professional fighting days.
So I was at that time I would have been, I think I was like a purple belt. I was an amateur fighter when I worked at the hospital.
How old were you by then?
This would have been 23 years old. So I worked at Denver Health, and I had a couple of different jobs while I was there. But the psych department was, so they had three psych departments. There was a pediatric psych, which was up on the fourth floor. There was an adult psych, the floor underneath that. And then there was a emergency psych down in the ER. And we would just run back and forth between all those.
What is emergency psych?
Emergency psych is like you haven't been admitted to the hospital as like a, you know, you're not on a 72-hour hold or something like that. You're just like, you are in serious distress. It could be drug-related or you're just losing your mind, whatever. And, you know, you get brought in by an ambulance and then they're going to give you a bunch of drugs and some guys got to come in and tie you down. I was one of those guys, you know? Yeah.
How do you get a job like that? Do you have to go to specialized training or?
I mean, what was the training? I think the training was through the hospital because I started as a security guard.
Yeah.
So I was just working hospital security. Like I was a courier. I took a class so I could carry a gun and I was like delivering money from the different clinics, you know, because Denver Health has some clinics in like some bad areas, right? So a dude would need to wear a gun and they didn't want to pay Brinks or whatever. So they had like, they had the hospital, you know, they had a bunch of kids doing it.
How do you go from that to, hey, help us out with this dude that we can't fuck?
Because there'd be calls. So you'd get a call on your radio that they needed backup in the psych department. And security was one of the, if you were one of the, you know, guards on duty that day, you might get called into psych to go help out. And I was just in there helping out all the time. And, you know, I was like dependable. I was good at it.
I mean, we've seen depictions of this in like popular culture and stuff like that. Like I think most people, when they think about that, they think about the Terminator 2 movie, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly
what,
but that's,
I mean,
where
that's,
my,
what, that's what it looked like.
That's where my mind goes to.
Yeah.
Somebody that is out of their mind, I guess. I don't know. Like I've had the experience of trying to subdue and arrest people who are fucking out of their head.
Dude, I've seen 10-year-old kids that were so strong. I mean, just
what is it? What explains somebody being hard to manage all of a sudden? Like this kid, 10 years old.
Yeah.
What is it? What do you think is going on?
I mean, the kid that I'm thinking about that day was, I know he was talking about like the devil and stuff like that. That one felt a little different. Like I felt some weird spiritual warfare stuff, but just on the surface, I think they had diagnosed that this kid was a schizophrenic, right? And
which is a very wide diagnosis.
Yeah. And he was not cooperating with the doctors and they decided that they wanted to restrain him. So like they leave him in the room, they come out, they say, yeah, we're going to go in there and restrain this guy. And then there was just like a standard protocol. You like, how many guys do you have? Right. I'm going to get left arm. You're going to get right arm, whatever. And you would like run in and grab these guys and then get them on the bed. And, you know, and then there were techs would strap them down. There was like, I don't remember the exact, you know, order of operations. I remember it sucked. Like there was all these rules you had to follow that.
Yeah.
I don't know who invented that system, but it wasn't a good system. But this particular kid, I mean, everybody left the room, these big, strong, you know, men and women, and they're trying to hold this kid down. And we come out, we're drenched in sweat. Like you couldn't, it was hard to understand how, like energy wise, it was like we were in there fighting a rhinoceros, you know? And this kid was little, 10 years old. I mean, he couldn't have been 80 pounds.
You mentioned the spiritual side of things. And yeah. I guess people will believe or not believe in all of these things.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen what I've seen, you know,
having somebody all of a sudden materialize the strength at 10 years old.
Yeah.
To like fight a bunch of dudes off. That seems outside of the natural.
It was insane. Yeah. And there was a doctor that was there with us. Right. And she was like, well, the human brain, you know, the right chemicals turn on. And I'm like, bullshit.
No,
you know?
No, I mean, I mean, you were somebody that would know about that. Now, having fought at the highest levels,
yeah,
did anything activate in your brain that all of a sudden gave you superpowers?
No, never. But I we're still trying to learn
really
that one.
I really want
to
win. No.
Doesn't happen.
There's I don't know. There's something about that where I don't know, possessions or shit like that. I don't know what it is.
I had a few experiences like that where it was done and you were just like, what the fuck just happened?
And when you said you felt something like, yeah. what for people that have never experienced that? Like for me, like I've been in rooms with people that I think there were something going on.
Yeah.
The dread, the staleness of the environment, I don't know about changes of temperature, but there's something off about people.
Yeah. I mean, this is going to sound a little weird, but I have always felt like from a very young age, I kind of have this like blessing of like knowing, like I just kind of, I'm like, man, that's some evil shit, or man, that's some good shit. Like, I think I'm a good judge of character. I think I can like, you know, kind of feel that energy or something. You know what I mean? Yeah. I don't know what that is, but I've definitely always had it. Okay. And in that room that day, it was dark.
I could tell you both of the two explanations that I've gotten from very high level people. One, a psychiatrist, and one, a spiritual worker.
Yeah.
He says, if you had to go into a mine, would you take a guy with you who was a miner, or would you take a guy in with you who was a baseball player?
Yeah.
The miner.
Take a miner.
Do you think the guy that is a miner was born in that mine to be a proper guide? No. Who was born in that mine? Nobody. But he knows about the mine.
Yeah.
So some of us that grow up around some of that shit and are experienced with that shit, that go through that shit, or that have some of that stuff around us, learn to see it or smell it or identify it.
That's right.
That's spiritual worker told me that. And the psychiatrist told me, oh, that's one of your superpowers with the ADHD, pattern recognition, observation. Like your head is stuck on survival constantly. So you're learning to identify small key things. Like when somebody's a narcissist and they're trying to hide it, you can tell that motherfucker out in a crowd. Like, oh, you're somebody that I should be worried about.
Bro, I can smell a narcissist a mile away.
Because probably you've encountered them and you learned something about that. I don't know. That's.
Yeah.
I every now and then I'm like, I sense something in the force. Like, no. I'm highly traumatized, and I realize that motherfucker hasn't taken his hand out of that pocket for a while.
Yeah, but, I mean, I don't think that the two have to be separated. Like, I think both people are saying the same thing. The one might say, like, you know, it's a gift. What if one person tells you have a gift from God, right? And then what if the next person says, well, God gives you gifts through the things that you experience and, you know, the hard stuff. He turns the hard stuff into good stuff.
And, you pray to God for strength, and he sends you a fucking storm.
That's right. That's right. He gives you an opportunity to be strong.
Or like Kanye West, and like Kanye, like in a fucking interview, and you can think about whatever you want about his opinions. I mean, he's clearly mentally unstable.
No.
Yeah, he's probably very autistic. But he said when he was interviewed, he said, like, when I asked God for strength, he killed my mom. And that was like, and then you can say like, well, he's a crazy person. He took over the world after that. He fucking took over the world.
People hate on him, but I haven't had an opportunity to listen to too much of what he says. But the stuff I've heard, I'm like, oh, fuck.
He's mentally, he's somebody that probably has some sort of spectrum autism. He grew up very sheltered with her mom. Mom went away. That was very traumatic. And then he got involved with a bunch of vampires.
Yeah, that's
the Illuminati sacrifice.
That's always been my take on it. What if this guy saw behind the curtain, saw how crazy and fucked up things are, and then it's so crazy that if you talk about it, you look crazy.
I mean,
I think that's what happened with
him. If there is a curtain and there is an Illuminati, you think that specific family would be a part of it that made billions of dollars because of posting a video online at some point?
Yeah.
And becoming the Kardashian? I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's not talk about that.
I think he's probably not as crazy as everybody thinks he is. You know, I think he just sounds crazy.
But that I think it was pretty powerful when he talked about that, you know, then God took his mom and And you can see the ascension afterwards, because like with shit like that, man, that transforms, you know. Or it's like two things. It'll either transform you and make you like fucking do some epic shit, or it'll eat you.
Yeah.
And you'll kill yourself in one way, shape, or form. You know, I did a bit of both, I think, in my life.
Hopefully you're working through that, right? You can't just leave it be. That dark stuff it stays dark unless you kind of put some light on it, you know?
What were you doing to handle the stress of working in that environment when you were there?
Dude, at the time I loved it. Like I loved it. We were seeing horrible shit, bro. You know, like, I mean, I've heard the stories about the things you've seen, but like working at Denver Health, I was seeing, you know, if you're working a Saturday night, you're seeing stabbings and shootings and, you know, I saw all horrible stuff. There was a lady in Denver who worked at the Denver Zoo. This is on a Saturday morning, and we get a call that they need security to go to the ambulance bay because they're worried that the press is going to be there, like reporters and stuff. Does that make sense? Like they're going to, the ambulance is going to pull up. They're going to take her out, and they want to, our job is to be there to make sure there's no cameras there. But we get there, there's no cameras there. So we just help the guys take her out of the thing and they wheel her in. This poor lady, dude, she works in the cat exhibit. You can look this up. Beautiful young girl. And she's walking in the little alleyway, you know, the little enclosed area between cages. And somebody forgot to close one of the doors. And this jaguar jumps on her back, bites the back, you know, separates her skull from her neck, kills her in one bite, drags her down the hall back into the cage. Then that's when somebody sees it. Cop comes running in, kills the cat. They bring her to us. I saw that lady, dude. I saw what the precision of how that cat killed her. And then the kid that's sitting at the security desk needs to go on lunch break. So I sit down to give him a lunch break, and this man comes in. He's like, I'm here to see my girlfriend. I'm like, oh, what's her name? He says her name, and I see. And I'm like, why don't you have a seat? He's like, yeah, apparently she got hurt at her job or something. She works at the zoo. I was like, yep, just have a seat. And then I watch, it's her fiance, dude. And I watch his reaction when the doctors are talking to him, and like he's wailing, bro. I would say from that hospital, it's not the gore and stuff that I saw doesn't haunt me. The reactions, tragedy. Yeah, tragedy. The crying and the wailing and that kind of stuff.
It is, dude. That's what stays.
Yeah, dude.
I mean, some of that shit, that's what the, it's because you can easily see yourself there.
Yeah, I have this like, I'm sure this drives my wife crazy, but I have this irrational fear of the driveway. Like my kids are not allowed to play in the driveway.
Yeah.
Like they need to stay in the fucking house. If I even see them in the driveway, I'm like, get out of the driveway, right? And then I was like, you know, and just the fear that it works up in me anytime that happens. And then I wanted to kind of get to the root of it. And it was this family is having a birthday party. And one of the guys decides he's got to make a run to the liquor store and throws his truck in reverse and just squishes this kid, dude. And then they bring the little guy in and he's dead. And they're trying to hide it and say that something else happened because the guy was drinking. And eventually it all gets exposed. And I had to just sit there in the room because they're worried that this family's going to like lose it, you know, and start attacking doctors or something. So there's a couple of security people in the room and I'm just spending, you know, 2 hours watching this family weep, dude. And it was fucking brutal.
Yeah.
And this is 20 years ago.
And there's probably no after action. They're just like, all right, go sit back down at your desk.
Yeah, dude. I'm just like, you know, and now my kids can't figure out why daddy gets so mad and yells when they're in the driveway.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, it sticks with
I'm getting better at it, but, you know?
Yeah.
So going back, you were working at that hospital like in your 20s. What got you, and you said you were like a purple belt at the time, you think in jiu-jitsu. What got you into jiu-jitsu into the first place? Was that your first try at martial arts was jiu-jitsu, or were you doing anything before that?
No, it was jiu-jitsu was my first martial art. It would have been, Hoyce Gracie was very relatable if you were someone who got bullied, right? Because like you look at this initial UFC tournament that he's in, first one ever, which was in Denver. And he looks like just this regular small guy. He's wearing even his outfit, he's wearing a gi in a fight and stuff, you know, and he's fighting like Kimo Leopoldo and the Shamrocks and these big, scary looking dudes. And those guys looked like the heroes that I wanted, the big, you know, no shirt on and big muscles and stuff. And I've always wanted to be that. But then this guy is just out there doing wizardry, just, you know, so a young me sees jujitsu and is like, what the fuck is that? I wanted it so bad, bro. We were doing jujitsu in the backyard before I ever found a jujitsu teacher, you know, like it was like
too exotic back then.
And so I imagine it was probably hard to find.
It was jiu-jitsu. Yeah. There was one that I had access to in Colorado. His name was David Ruiz. David Ruiz had spent time in California training with the Gracies. And I want to say he was like a purple belt maybe. And he had a little club and he was teaching some guys. So when I was 16, 17 was when I first started getting access to jiu-jitsu from those guys. And, you know, just kind of did it on and off. My family was very poor. So I couldn't afford lessons, you know? So I was just like doing what I could. Eventually, when I was like 19, I would clean the mats at David Ruiz's gym and trained with him for probably about a year. But MMA came from Marquardt, from Nate Marquardt. I had broken up with this girl in college and went through this phase where I just like sold all my shit. You know, I was like bare bones. I got like a mattress and one pair of jeans. And
that's me now.
It felt good, dude. It was very therapeutic. Yeah.
It's me now. Dude, the shit up. It's like you can't do that at 40. No,
you can. You can do whatever you want, man.
I'm making you have more stuff. I got some stuff for you in the trunk.
This fucker bought me a Christmas tree. It's the first one I've ever had.
Nice, bro. 40, all right.
No, dude, I'm just ashamed of that shit, dude. But the whole aspect of this whole aspect of like fucking selling anything off. Like I've been there a few times myself. It's like it's like a reset, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was just like, you know, I had like a nervous breakdown. Basically, I was dating this girl that was way out of my league, right? And I'm just a young idiot. I'm just lying. My whole life is a lie. I'm just lie after lie. And as these lies are coming unraveling, eventually this girl cheats on me and breaks up with me. And so I just went back to the one thing that couldn't cheat on me, and that was jujitsu. So I got rid of all my shit and started doing jujitsu, met Nate.
Hyper-focused.
Yeah.
Did you have any sort of like, hey, this is great. This is pretty cool. These guys are admirable. That guy's showing me some shit. Let me figure out this professional fighting thing.
Yeah, the fighting, I remember specifically when the fighting thing happened. I went down to Albuquerque. You guys have been to Albuquerque? That's a wild place, right? So there was a fight team there called Jackson's MMA. And I mean, back in the day, that was the mecca. That's where you went for MMA, yeah. Nate was training down there. He brought me down. I was training with like Keith Jardine and Joey Villasenor. You guys remember Joey? Joey was a bad motherfucker. Those guys just beat the shit out of me. I mean, it was brutal. I was pretty good at jiu-jitsu at the time. Like in Colorado, I was one of the better guys.
What year is this?
Let's see. I would have been probably 22, 23. So this is like, you know, whatever that is. Early 2000s, 2005, maybe 2006. So I go down there. I get beat up. And the drive back to Denver takes 8 hours. And on that drive, I was like, I'm quitting my job. I'm moving to Albuquerque. I'm learning how to fight. Like,
yeah, it's experiencing warlocks. And you're like, I need to learn their fucking magic.
These guys are so good. And MMA was just MMA was a different animal. I was good at jiu-jitsu, but as soon as we started punching on the floor, like the blending of the skills, some guys aren't good at that. Some guys are like, you know, like the other night, Buchecha fought. He's a great jiu-jitsu guy, right?
Yeah.
Not a great fighter. I mean, even like some of the best jiu-jitsu guys ever have tried to do MMA and they're just not, you know, they don't translate. I think it's the ADD, but I'm really good at the multitasking, like the rolling and punching and everything at the same time. And
The piecing it out, like, hey, this makes sense in the context of a jiu-jitsu match, but I need to get on my feet and I probably need to control a limb because they might land punches on me. So let me modify this.
Yeah.
So basically you're able to construct Lego sets.
Well, yeah. And it was just like, if let's say you're, let's say you're, we're evenly matched in jiu-jitsu. Well, let's say we're evenly matched in chess. But every time that you reach down to move a piece, I flick your nose. You know, that's what MMA is. It's like, it's learning how to constantly take you slightly out of position and, you know, you just never let you get going.
Disruptive thinking.
Yeah. Offensive cycle.
Yeah. This is early 2000s. I mean, I remember the UFC back then. I had Bellator and all these fucking guys. The personalities, the specimens of humanity back then.
It was still a very underground kind of thing too.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. But early on, I mean, I don't know. Like I remember watching Pancrase and shit like that.
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah.
Voss, specifically Voss Rutten. I remember seeing, I think he was the first example of I also remember the Gracie Gi guy and like, oh, yeah. That guy's amazing.
Boss is out there wearing knee-high boots.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
palm striking motherfuckers, dude.
He's like a big white luchador almost.
Yeah.
Without the mask.
And I was like, how did this change happen so quickly from this dude with the gi to now this dude just cracking people and just going for some of these fuck those kicks he would have. It was.
Yeah.
But the fact that he's this physical specimen on top of that. The grappling and also the striking.
So good, and he had bad intentions. You know?
And I think that's the generation that you're kind of like coming up in, right?
This. Dude, I, you know, now I can look back on it and just be like, wow. But I had no idea just how blessed I was in those moments. Like I was, dude, there are, you know, hundreds of pictures of me being in the only guy in the room that isn't like fighting on TV and famous already. And I just like, these were my training partners. Like these guys all, I mean, half of them are in the UFC Hall of Fame. I got to hang out and around George St. Pierre countless times, like trips to Canada where he's like driving us around. We're all staying in the same hotel together and just like training and learning. But to me, like I knew it was special, but I didn't know how special it was.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, you're getting to see what makes somebody like that be at that level.
Yeah, dude, I was like a regional pro or maybe a high level amateur, and I'm watching guys fight for world titles. And you and I talked about this before. I'm watching their coaches because, dude,
that's where the sauce
just
is.
Yeah, to have access to those coaches, like, and I'm not just talking Greg Jackson. We're also talking Trevor Whitman, Dwayne Ludwig, Firas Sahabi. Great. Like these are the top coaches in the world at the time. And we're getting, you know, spending weeks at a time with them.
And also really cool. In a realm that is new, basically, this is they're the top of their game in a game that is still figuring out what it is.
Well, and these guys, even to this day, you can go into certain rooms and there'll be a wrestling coach, a striking coach, and a jiu-jitsu coach. And like, you're learning your skills separately. These guys were teaching MMA. They were looking at it as a single art back then, 20 years ago, you know?
And
they're still, half the teams haven't caught up to that.
We visited you in Denver recently.
That was fun, right?
That was. I got to see you, like, that aspect of you. That was pretty cool to see. Seeing this fighter working certain thing. I mean, I never thought about it in that way. The way you were... You can learn things separately, mm-hmm. but there's another type of mind where you have to like have somebody that knows how all of these go together. And I think that's where I was seeing you like shine. And
the system.
Yeah. You systemize all these things that traditionally and only a few decades ago were all separate, but now they're not only in the same realm or in the same box.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of sophistication as far as how to make it even better and meld well. I think it's how I kind of saw you taking that apart. You fought Bellator once.
Yeah.
You said, well, what was that experience? I mean, I remember seeing it.
Yeah, it was a good experience. I had a rough career. Like I had a really hard time staying active, whether it was injuries or fights falling through or whatever. And then this Bellator opportunity comes and I was like, yeah, let's go. Ended up fighting a tough guy, finished him. I had just started working with a mental coach back then to try to like, you know, tap into like peak performance.
Were you looking for that because you realized it was like a hole in you, or like where did that come from?
I realized that I did have the hole because, my skills weren't, the translation wasn't there. So like, let's say I have 100% of these skills and only like 40% of them were showing up on fight night for whatever reason, like the nerves or it is, you know, just yeah. It is what it is. It gets the best out of all of us. Right.
Can I ask you that? And that's like, I've been in a lot of fights and shit like that.
Yeah.
But I realize specifically like, you know, being around people like you and seeing you prepare other people at a high level. I can't imagine the amount of pressure that is on an individual stepping into a ring,
yeah.
representing not only himself, but also the people that made him, formed them, trained with him, fucking sweated it out with him, cried with them, supported them, fed them. You could slept on a couch and all that shit.
Yeah.
And kind of your country too, maybe. Like if you're fighting somebody from another country.
Now, mentally, how's that? Like, I can't imagine. I don't know.
Dude, it's a lot. It's a lot. And if you're not dealing with those thoughts and you carry all that in there, it's going to go one way or another. It's either going to crumble you, or there's a small percentage that like they're gamers and that like brings it out of them, you know? I think
it shows up in you doubting yourself, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it just shows up in like, you know, it's like you got one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake. So like you want to go, but you just can't go.
Hesitate.
You know? Yeah.
Musashi used to talk about having no mind.
That's right. No mind. The not, what they say, the not mind. Wait, the no mind, not thinks, no thoughts or something like that.
Yeah. Which I know what it is. Like if you've ever been in a situation where like, fuck it. It's like, that's literally what it is.
Yeah.
Fuck it. I'm going to allow the investment that I had in the past 10 years going into rooms and utilizing firearms. I'm going to trust that that is enough.
Yeah. And it's really easy to do if a fight just spontaneously happens. Like some guy kicks this door in right now.
Yeah.
We're going to fight well.
Yeah. But.
Yeah. But it's in that like.
But now you're seeing like weigh-ins mm-hmm. and like, hey, this and like chit talking and.
Yeah.
Do you like the anticipation or no?
No, I didn't. As a fighter, I did not like that. No. And I, you know, I was trying to get better at it. That Bellator fight was the first time that my skills translated really well. I felt calm. I felt totally present. I remembered the whole fight.
So cool, that's cool. Present.
Yeah.
For people that don't know what that means, like, what is that? What do you say that you felt present in that fight and not present, maybe so much present in the others?
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that I work with my guys so much right now, you know, is that like, if you are focused on the outcome of the fight, that is a moment in the future that is not real. So you are focused on something fake. You're focusing on something that's not.
It's like when you think there's a step there and there's nothing there. Yeah. And you're just like.
Yeah. And guess what? While you're focused on this fake thing, there's a person in front of you trying to hurt you.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So you focus on effort, not outcome. You focus on the process and you let the results, you know, you basically try to win a race. And if some, you know, if a submission happens, a finish happens, something like that, great. You saw how I do this with my guys. I prioritize where, when, what,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So by constantly prioritizing where we are standing in relationship to our partner, you know, that kind of thing, it forces us to stay present. We can get deep into that, but in that particular fight, I was there. I was actually there in the room. I remember it. I knew where people were sitting. It was like, I didn't get all worked up. I didn't let the moment get so big that, you know, that I got like lost or something. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Would you say that would be like being in the zone? That.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's the same thing.
But, yeah. So flow state is what some people talk about and like, oh, you're there. You don't even no, you do realize. It's like a hyper awareness of actually realizing you're in the moment and what you're doing. And it's not leaving it going automatic. It's trusting that you know what you're fucking doing.
Like, that's like, just confidence.
And it feels good. It's not even confidence, man. It's like, I'm going to divert a little spirituality thing in there for a second. So sometimes when I'm meditating, this weird thing happens where I get like totally present. You know, like it almost like my body's tingling And one of the things that I've described it to people is I'm like, dude, I feel like God is like looking through my eyes, like he's experiencing this thing with me for a second. It's weird, right? I've been able to do that maybe two or three times in my life. But that's what it feels like when you're totally present in a fight, right? So like whatever, I don't get into this with all of my fighters, but imagine this. Imagine there's all these life forms. We're all living, right? And imagine something created us. And imagine that like, if they do the work and they get present, that thing gets to come in and experience what you're doing for a second. That's what it feels like to me. Yeah. It feels like you're wired into something unexplainable.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I had a weird dude showed me some pretty like life-changing pack, I guess. We would do shooting training in rooms. And I realized, and a lot of us realized, that we would go into rooms and we would shoot at paper, right? And they would be placed in different parts of the room and go over repetitive and just would do the same thing. But when we were out there in the world, that's not how the world works. You know, it's not all linear. It's not a box. It's not. And so he said that you have to add elements of controlled chaos into the environment. And also you have to add problem solving into the environment. So we would go into a room and it would be shoot the red balloons only.
Mm-hmm.
And not the blue ones, or shoot the blue ones only and not the red ones. Or now there's, you go in there and instead of a balloon color being shouted out, it's a number. So it forces you to be present. Now it's not, now you can't just like, I'm just going to allow myself to go into this robot flow state.
That's right.
So you have to like really be present.
Yep.
And he said somewhere in that chaos, you will start. It will start clearing up to you, like what you're actually have to focus on. So
I took a low light handgun course where they did almost the same thing. That's interesting.
And if you want to add an extra layer there, what I do next after doing very similar to what you just described, I would add external consequences. So I would say, okay, we're going to run this test, right? Like maybe we have a game called the Get Up game. So imagine I put the two of you on the floor. And we're going to see how many times you can get up and break contact in 5 minutes. And then when you're done, then you get to go. But the loser is going to go outside and do burpees, you know, until they barf or something. I wouldn't do that. The fighters could, but you understand what I'm saying. Yeah. They're going to have a consequence that really sucks, right? Because when you first add that outside consequence, what happens is everybody gets too serious, too intense, too strict, right? You know, like they want to not lose so bad that they stop performing. And this is so similar to what happens in a fight. Because in a fight, it's not which one of us is a better fighter. It's what is everybody going to say when this is done? What is everybody going to think? Am I going to get that belt? Am I going to get that money? You know, does that make sense?
You're not in the task. I mean, you're going to miss the nail on the board because you're thinking about the house.
Yeah. So if we can create a shitty external consequence that's going to happen at the end of this thing and still get you to be calm enough to do your job, that's a really strong training tool.
No problem.
Yeah.
Controlled trauma, basically. Well, yeah.
I mean, because what happens? Like, let's say you make a cookie and you make the best fucking cookie we've ever had. Everyone's always talking about how good your cookie is, and then someone's like, "Yo, there's a cookie contest next month, dude, and the winner gets $10,000."
I'm serving.
You gotta
I'm
go.
Nervous.
Yeah, you gotta. Go, yeah, you gotta go make this cookie. And then what happens is the night before not only do you want the money, but you also like all your boys are like, they think your cookie's fucking good, man. You know? And like, there's a little bit of pressure there. And you're like, now all of a sudden you're not just making it because you love seeing people smile and making cookies. There's like something else. Yeah. There's a little ego in there. Right. So what happens is you say, you get there at the cookie table and you're like, all right, you know what? I'm going to go big on this one. I'm going to put a little bit of this and I'm going to try a little bit of this and I'm going to do this thing that I saw that guy do and I'm going to make this cookie extra special. And then you lose because that's not your fucking cookie. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And that's what happens.
I'm over here trying to like remember now that you've said like being present in the moment for all your fights. Like I'm trying to think, like I don't feel like out of all the times I've competed, I have really been like present. Like
it's been a fray for you.
It's just been like going through the motion, whether I win or lose. I can't recall like feeling like present, remembering it. But then I'm trying to think of another time where I competed And it was doing that off-road racing in Baja. And you were competing against with all the other drivers in their cars. And that feels like I was present, because I remember everything about that. But all the competitions, all the fights I've done, like, I barely remember them, whether win or lose. Yeah. But I remember competing. So I'm wondering, like, I wonder if that's because, like, that I very much enjoyed that. It was just, like, at the top of my, like, bucket list kind of stuff. Or, like, I'm wondering why I was competing with the other people, too. But I'm wondering why I remember that so well, to where all my competitions, like, just barely remember them.
Well, let me ask you this.
I just never felt present. Like, I felt present in that off-road thing, but not in any of my other, like, jiu-jitsu competitions or anything like that.
Well, you weren't present because there was thoughts in your head, right? The only thing that prevents you from being present is thought. So, have you guys ever heard of hourglass of peak performance? Have you ever done this?
No.
Or some version of it? So, no. Imagine the shape, like, imagine a 2D hourglass. So, it's wide, it gets skinny, it gets wide again. Like, yep. You know, like the sand falls through the center. So you want to draw one of these on a piece of paper, and then you want to just kind of make some little slashes down and some lines. And these lines are going to represent these steps that you're going to do to kind of funnel your thoughts down to this little skinny place in the middle. Because the top of the hourglass is you every day. The bottom is you every day. The middle is that version of you that has no thoughts that you want in competition.
Avatar state.
Yeah, yeah. And then you're just going to practice this. So let's walk you through. So let's say you're going to practice tonight to train, right? Okay, so you get in your car, you listen to some music. So that's step one. You're just breathing, listening to music, calming down. Maybe, you know, tuning out the outside world. Maybe you put your phone on pause, right? No more calls. Okay. Then you're going to get out of your car. You're going to walk to the threshold of the gym. You're just going to take a second, take a breath, and you're going to walk into that space. And you're going to imagine setting your troubles down at the door, and it's going to be waiting for you after practice. Then you're going to go to the locker room. You're going to change out of your clothes, fold them up, and then put on your fucking Batman outfit, right? You're going to put on this outfit that you fight crime in, this outfit that you battle in, this outfit that doesn't, when you put this outfit on, you don't, there's no room for thoughts. This is your battle outfit. Then you're going to walk over, you're going to bow on the mat. There's another threshold. You have another opportunity to set down just whatever thoughts you still have with you. And you do your warm up. Then you have a good practice and you battle and you're intentionally getting rid of your thoughts. And then after practice, cool down, bow off the mat, wash that practice off, watch it go down the drain, put your fucking clothes back on, walk back out the door and pick up your problems. Listen to some music in your car. Turn your phone back on. Like, you know, you're doing gradual stuff. Not everybody has the patience or the time to do this. But, dude, if you practice this, this shit works.
I think that's why it works. I like jiu-jitsu and, like, single player sports, I guess, is because, like, for, like, jiu-jitsu or snowboarding or even riding motorcycles, it's because that's the only thing I can think about at that time. So, like, really nothing else matters besides what I'm doing right then, because or else I'm probably going to get hurt.
That's right.
So I think that's why I enjoy it so much, but I just can't recall, like, being in the moment minus that one.
Well, you probably have it in practice all the time.
Yeah.
And then you don't have it in competition. Maybe. And it's because of external consequences. It's because of the, what are other people say? What's other people going to think? It's just all that shit.
Or some shit that happened to you in the past that makes you fucking blur out memories of that nature. That's another aspect of it as
Could
well.
Could
be. Bingo.
Could be. Because I was just like you. I was bullied a shit ton. And then, so.
Maybe it feels like that.
Yeah, there's a link of dissociation there with you. I mean, women that have gone through, like, sexual assaults will dissociate as well.
Because even, like, even the competitions I've won or lost, like, they're barely rememberable.
I wanted to take this opportunity to thank each and every one of our Patreon members for the generous support. It's the only way we can bring some of these amazing people behind the microphone and have some of these amazing Midnight of the Soul conversations for you guys. If you're not already a part of the Patreon community, please consider joining us. We have our giant online training catalog for you guys to have access to, as well as some exclusive Sneak Reaper Industries merch drops for you guys at the dead drop here. I would also like to thank the company Sneak Reaper Industries, one of our main supporters and a company that provides some of the most amazing urban wear, survival specific, and cutlery out there. Thank you. for your support. And again, please consider joining us on the Patreon. And now back to the show.
Speaking of Batman, you have an interesting Batman story that I heard in Denver.
I didn't hear Batman. Where was that?
You did. You probably don't remember. It's a good story. You would remember this one. So maybe you didn't.
All right. So I'm going to start by saying that I do not condone this with my students. All right.
Anyone.
Yeah. This was, you know, I was a, it's no secret. Like when I was young, I was an idiot, you know?
And like, I think were you smart when you were younger?
I'm still not smart.
Yeah.
I'm so not a smart man.
We haven't evolved. We haven't evolved. Gen A.
Yeah. So this is Boulder, Colorado. This would have been like, dude, I don't know. Very early 2000s. So a bunch of my buddies went to college up there. I went to college in Denver, but I couldn't afford to live by myself. So I thought it was a good idea to live up there with them. And then I got to, you know, chase girls and be on the party scene and stuff. It was fun. But we had a game that we would play sometimes called Batman. So Batman would go like this. Me and my buddy David, we'd stay sober, but we'd go out to the bars and we'd try to find some, like, you know, jock asshole, like, pushing his chick around or picking on somebody, or, you know, we'd find that guy, you know?
And there's always that.
Yeah.
Guy.
Usually somebody, like, you know,
yeah,
hits his girl or, you know, whatever, or just being a bully, right? Somebody just being an asshole. And then we would follow them around from like bar to bar, you know, and just kind of like until the guy was just like hammered. And then everybody walks home, you know, everybody walks home from Pearl Street and goes up the hill and we would follow them. And then wait until it was dark and we'd get in some fights, but you know, yeah, I'm not going to get into the details too much, but we would at some point in it, you know, you'd be like, I'm Batman,
dude,
which was the best part,
dude. Yeah. Imagine somebody like, wait, he's real. You just get your ass kicked somewhere in the field. Like, fuck.
Did you ever tell that to somebody, like, why they're laying on their back?
Yeah. He'd be like, what? I don't even know you. Why are you doing this? You'd be like, I've been watching you. I'm Batman. This was before Christian Bale.
Batman will always be to me. Michael like Keaton.
Yeah.
Fuck that, dude. Rachel. No, fuck that guy. Michael Keaton putting dynamite down a fucking clown's pants and just been smiling. That's fucking Batman to me.
Michael Keaton's the best. So yeah, that was Batman. We used to follow these guys home and get in fights. And yeah.
I mean, like,
it did backfire once.
Do you feel sorry about it?
No.
Oh, God damn it. I was going to say that. Then it means it's fine.
Bullies get there.
No, I didn't feel sorry for
no,
it.
No, but you have to let the, you know,
I mean, like,
look, the Lord says vengeance is mine. You have to let him sort of, right?
So like we, you know, I wasn't like, I didn't hospitalize anybody.
No, I know.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
I would just like...
It's
give him a little spanking.
Yeah. Just, you know.
Yeah, every now and then I would stop people were driving under the influence, you know. I'm not a traffic cop, so I would grab their keys and their shoes.
Yeah.
And just throw them in a ravine.
There you go.
And just leave them in a parked car.
These guys needed to get punched in the nose, and they did. That's, you know. So that was the Batman story. I mean, if we weren't recording this, those stories would probably get a little better.
We'll save that for.
I will tell you one time that it backfired. So I'm with the same guy, Dave. We follow this guy into this courtyard of this like apartment, you know, and we're talking, yelling back and forth to him, and he knows we want to fight, and he's like, well, there's two of you, and I'm not trying to get jumped. I was like, I'm not trying to jump you. And then he says, well, can I get my brother? And I'm like, I'm thinking like it's his brother. I don't realize it's his frat brother. So he's like, yeah, he yells around the corner and like 10 dudes come out. What? All his frat brothers. It sucked.
It's a melee.
Yeah, it's.
I mean, you could be.
How long did you guys last? Was it two against 10?
Not long. No, I got sucker punched real bad from the side.
I've had the religious experience of being beaten unconscious few times in my life.
Yeah.
And two of them were a mob of people. So there is no weapon forged that you can have in your hand or skill set that you can have in your hand that will allow you to take care of more than three people, I think. Mm. Once there's more than three.
Yeah. Well, like timing and position might be able to handle three. Like if you do some real dirty.
Because I've seen that fight with two heavyweights against 10 amateurs.
As soon as you change levels and there's somebody at a higher level than you that is part of a third or fourth.
As long as they're all smaller than you.
Dude, man.
Yeah, I think space is a determining factor for sure, right? Yeah. And then like if you can do the most violent jacked up thing first, you know, then you get that shock and awe. Yeah. But
Once you start getting people rapping.
Yeah, I think the number for me is probably now. I mean, I'm old now, but back then the number was probably four people.
Four, man. I got it. Three was like, fuck.
And then you start negotiating. Then it's like, all right, I'm sorry. Let me get my flip flops. I'm trying to get out of here.
Or, it's like, or if you're in Mexico, you're like,
God.
I've heard.
So you heard.
Maybe just a few like gunshots next to your ear so you can get moving around. One thing we didn't kind of go into, you did a few fights in the UFC. You had a UFC career, which is, I mean, we can say now, like after everything, that's probably, it's the institution that survived till our day. There's a lot of controversy around it. Yeah. I want to kind of talk, get your opinion on some of the stuff that's going on now.
Sure.
But what was your UFC experience like? You go into this arena. Are you excited about it? Is it something you were aiming at?
Yeah. I mean, I think goal setting, one of the things that I work with my fighters is like making sure that their goal setting, number one, actually aligns with what they want. Right. But then also that they're thinking big. So my goal was to fight in the UFC. Right. And that's not a big enough goal because once you get there, then what, you know?
Yeah. I never thought about it.
Yeah. It was interesting. And I didn't know it at the time either. Also, my career was kind of very stagnant and filled with injuries. So I remember I had talked to my wife and I was like, I think it might be time to move on. It's time to do something else, you know? And also back then was when I was kind of, started diving into my own spirituality, right? And I remember having this like really authentic conversation with God where I was like, look, put me where you want me. Like wherever I'm supposed to be, put me there. If it's not doing this anymore, if I'm not supposed to chase this fight dream, if I'm supposed to move on to something else, like show me what it is, right?
When you say that to your, when you say that to yourself, which... Yeah. That could sound atheistic, but that is sure. That well, is like, well,
I respect your beliefs.
I'm an aspect of God. So, you know, what are you expecting? Like,
signs, I'm just like,
my leg's going to break or my,
yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know, but I know that it was the first time where it was like real. Like I was like,
would you call that faith?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that back then my faith was like cute faith. Like I didn't have faith. Yet,
you don't have like Alu Akbar.
Definitely not that. But I, you know, like I was experimenting with faith and I put my faith in that and I was like, put me where you want me. And then I'm at the grocery store like a couple days later and my manager calls and he's like, dude, I think we got a fight. How much do you weigh? And I'm like, why? He's like, well, it's quick, dude. It's 7 days or no, 9 days, 9 days. And I was like, I'm 235. And he's like, can you make 206? And I was like, I can make it. Where's the fight? He goes, Australia. And I go, Australia? What organization? And he's like, sit down. And I was like, shut the fuck up. Like, what? And he's like, yeah, bro, they're going to give you a 3-fight deal if you take this short notice fight in Australia. You know, and for me, that's, you know, especially back then, it was like,
did you laugh at yourself a little bit? Like, motherfucker.
Yeah, dude, I did.
And this is it.
I was like, let's go. So we go to Australia. I have this horrendous weight cut, you know, but I make weight. I fight this, he's a heavyweight coming down to 205. His name was Nick Penner, Canadian guy. And, you know, the cut was so brutal that like almost every punch that he lands, like wobbles me or knocks me down. Like my brain is just fried, right? Like I just.
There's no liquid.
No liquid. But somehow I pull it through and I end up, you know, I get knocked down twice, I think. One of the times, I shit you not, I have this, I can watch what actually happened on TV, right? Like I can go watch the video now. But from my memory, I get hit and I'm like laying on this pillow and I'm like totally relaxed. And it feels like somebody's like knocking on the door. And I remember being like, what the fuck, man? I'm chilling. Stop knocking on the door or something. Like, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah. And then there's this little voice in my head that says, you're in Australia fighting. Wake up, motherfucker. And I fucking wake up and I'm arm barring him. Like in my sleep.
Yeah.
You know, and he pulls out of the armbar and I kick him and I get up. And then it just settles in. It was like, oh, like every, then I was just in the
zone.
That's
the one where you did an up kick, right? You were on your
back. Up kicked him, and then I get up and then I knock him out with a big left hand and get on top of him and just smash him, you know? But
that's almost hallucinogenic, like in description.
Bro, it was wild. So, and I remember it vividly, you know? And then, he cracked my orbital lobe. Like, it was a rough fight, dude. Yeah. But so I flew to Australia with an overdrafted checking account. Like, legit had, like, I was like negative $17 or something. And then I get the fight of the night bonus. I get the show money and the win money. I fly home with like 60, 70 grand in my checking. I was like,
so God told you, hey,
he said, here's
stick around a bit.
Yeah. But I think that I got the experience of fighting in the UFC because, like we talked about.
You need
like,
to cook?
Yeah, I got that experience, man. Yeah. Now, like, it makes my words as a coach much more relevant. But I don't think that
you talk about goal setting. That's interesting. You said your goal was the UFC, but that's a really fucking puny goal.
Yeah.
I mean.
Dude, in my community, that's a puny
relative,
goal.
Relative.
I mean, what happens after?
Yeah, I know a lot of shitty fighters that have fought in the UFC. Like, but back then, to me, it was like, it was either I fought in the UFC or I didn't. Like, to me, it weighed a lot back then. It weighs less to me now.
I saw Ronda Rousey go on this rant about, you know, how people. UFC fans are horrible because basically they're like they're in it behind you while you're winning, and then when you lose, you know, like fuck you.
Yeah.
Like and I've seen that phenomenon with like many like high level fighters who are like amazing, you know.
Yeah.
The Spider Silva, I remember him just going on this.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he fucking breaks his fucking leg, and then it seems like people. You know, you have two types that go through that, and you have the people that make a career of now turning themselves into a brand and going that route, which is like rare, you know. Yeah. And then you have the people that turn themselves into these people that create other fighters. And as you say, like right now, we're seeing a lot of people in the corners of people at the UFC who were in the But before that, that wasn't the case. Not really, not mostly.
Well, none of our coaches had fought when we were fighting, right?
That's wild. Yeah.
They were good at what they did. Like my wrestling coach was a great wrestler and he fought a few times. Like,
but now if you would go into the past and you would stand next to your wrestling coach, you would probably tweak and modify some of the things he was having to show you because you have already been in that.
Yeah. I mean, with all respect to those guys, I believe in my systems. I think that my systems don't exist without them. But I'd take my system over anybody's. That's you know, they're ever evolving. We collect data, right? We every weekend we just collect more data and we move make changes.
Yeah, I mean, it's like after action, modify, adapt, and evolve.
Simplify,
take what doesn't work. And if there's something that people have the theory about it working.
Yeah.
Let's see who was the weirdo is going to cook with this, you know, whatever that could be.
How often did you really use the advice that they were calling out? Cause
I wasn't a great fighter. That's one of the reasons why I wasn't a great fighter was like, I couldn't even hear them sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of the, like I have fighters right now. Last weekend we were in, or 2 weekends ago, we were in Las Vegas, right. With Macy and Macy was in an arena full of people beating up that girl. And it was like, we were just having a conversation.
She could hear you.
I mean, it was, dude, she was so calm and she was, it was like playing a video game.
So like,
and she was making good choices. So there wasn't really that much stuff we had to say, you know, and like that.
Like that's, I never thought, I mean, realistically that's a giant advantage being able to take direction in a fucking
jiu-jitsu. You would think that like, you would already know what to do, but when your coach is calling out like, hey, you know, do this from this, like sometimes it helps. And then sometimes, I don't know.
I remember a couple fights where it helped it when I was fighting. I remember a fight where I got in a little bit of trouble on the floor and Elliot Marshall walked me through some stuff like step by step. And it was like something I knew how to do, but in the moment I was just kind of frozen and that helped. I remember my striking coach, you know, giving little pointers.
God forbid you lose and because you didn't do something they said.
Yeah. I mean, so like I'm not a
I've
huge.
I've experienced that too.
If I need to walk you through something in a fight, we'll do it. But if I need to walk you through something in a fight, like I feel like, and we failed on the front end. Like imagine if we take a whole concept. So like, imagine we say that like, you're going to fight this guy and you're going to get in real close and you're going to use that wall fighting that I showed you in Colorado. And the goal is going to be to get in there and you have three or four outcomes that it's going to lead to. And just, you know, based on what this guy does, and we've already drilled it and we call that Skeletor. Right.
Yeah.
And now in the fight, instead of me saying, walking you through and saying all that stuff, I just say Skeletor. I go, yeah. And you're like, you know what fucking Skeletor means? Cause for 8 weeks we've been fucking calling it that. And if I want Beastman, I'll say Beastman, right? Or you know, if I want Trapjaw, I'll say Trapjaw, but it's going to be Skeletor. Those are also
Masters
of the Universe characters.
It's a personal language.
Yeah.
We do the same thing in football. Like
that's right.
Last minute.
Yeah. So we take these concepts and we give them names and it's coded. It can change from athlete to athlete. A lot of times it doesn't. Cause that can just get a little complicated, but, I love that shit though. Like that creating like that, that's how the art degree shows up now. It's like,
yeah.
Are you enjoying coaching more or do you think you enjoyed fighting more?
Coaching more. I always had those thoughts. Like what if my body would have held up a little bit better? It was really discouraging to get signed in the UFC and be at this place where my vestibular system was jacked up. Like I wasn't taking damage well. I had my hip and my shoulder were all fucked up. Like that's super frustrating.
Was in your mind, is it that you were too late?
Yeah.
You were too late to
because of your age?
Well, that's what I thought at first. Yeah. I thought it was too late, but now I think it's like, I think it couldn't have been timed better. It's perfect. I mean, I've coached in the UFC like 100 times or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I only fought in the UFC like 4 times.
Yeah. Your perspective changed with time.
Yeah.
That's wild to think about. Like some of us get stuck in this shit where you're like, yeah, I should have done a shit. And then you don't realize the benefit of that experience until it comes to fruition.
Because what if you would have kept going and taken too much damage and couldn't even coach?
That's going to be my question. As we kind of like wrap things up. Like what is that moment or decision like when you've been putting your body, your mind, your soul, your family at this point, because you're married, you're putting everybody through this. I don't know. It's hard to even comprehend the building your body to fight other people and doing that professionally and just having everything hang on the fact that you have to knock out or fucking subdue somebody.
Roller coaster.
And then you're at the end of it.
Yeah.
Which, you know, everybody prepares you for the beginning, the middle, but the ending of things is usually ignored, the conclusion.
Yeah.
What's that moment like for you? Like, what happens when you're like, you know what? That was the last one.
Yeah, it sucks. You know, I mean, especially in that moment. In the moment, it was extremely difficult. My last fight was in Ireland. And I knew I was done. You know, I thought, no disrespect to that opponent, but I believe in the training room, that's a guy trash, but I lost to him, you know, and I was just like, well, obviously I can't do this anymore. You know, like I'm not fighting to my capacity. It's just not happening. You know, my body's so jacked up and yeah. I got super depressed. I started drinking a lot of red wine, like a lot of red wine. And legitimately was like getting an anxiety like disorder. And so then had to like cut all of that out and like be like, yo, what am I doing? And had to like, what's next? What does this look like? And
you had we've seen what your vision is now, like going to Denver and seeing your gym.
That's amazing.
Like, dude,
yeah,
it is
It's the most impressive gym that I've ever been to. That's
independently of the gym, dude. The people there, that you're working on shit, you know, the whole mathematics of it and the systemization of it.
The proof is in the pudding with Macy, too.
Yeah. But like, it's amazing. How the fuck do you get there from having your problem with fucking red wine and just depression?
One step at a time, bro. I think a big piece of it was some of the athletes that trusted me early on. So, you know, some of the fighters that trusted me, you know, if I'm like, hey, I got this crazy idea. I want us to chase a little bit. Let's try this. And then these guys are willing to go do it. I mean, I would give a massive shout out to one of my fighters, Curtis Blades. I've done like 20 fights with him. And, you know, along the way, him and Vinny Lopez, you met Vinny. Remember Vinny? We did the gun class. You know, that was the three of us doing just, you know, trusting each other and trying shit out.
I think that trust aspect of it.
Yeah.
Who do you trust as a fighter who's about to put your body into that ring? Another fighter, maybe.
Yeah.
Or some dude that, you know, has theories around stuff. You know, I think that the whole aspect of that being essential to the plot, you know?
Right. Like, and that kind of takes us full circle, right? Like, that's where we started talking about today, is how, like, you can go through these things that can be perceived as shitty, and they're not. Like, without them, you don't get to the good place, you know? Like, I always tell people, you know, this is like some like biblical stuff, but I heard a pastor say this, a really good pastor, this Pastor Tom. He said, don't waste your wilderness, you know? So like when God puts somebody in the desert for 40 days or whatever, right? It's not by accident. And you want to like, you need to sit in that shittiness. You need to sit in that warfare in your head and pay attention, you know, and cause you'll come out the other side with, you know, with some clarity and some purpose and all that. And that clarity and purpose probably doesn't happen without the shittiness. Mm-hmm. So we're in this place where we all like, you know, like, man, I wish I knew what I wanted in life, man. I wish I had this. I wish I had this. I wish I had, let's just say I want clarity and vision. And I want to know I just don't even know what I want anymore. All right, well, where do you think you're going to find that, right? You find that in a shitty place.
Yeah.
I think.
You for me, like, I remember going from being active and doing all the shit that I was doing.
Yeah.
To now being in an avocado orchard in California, going through my immigration process and having none of my weapons, none of my responsibility, none of my purpose. Well, all that shit's gone. All the stuff that I've invested everything into is gone. And I'm sitting in this avocado orchard drinking my fifth Foster's big can beer.
Horrible.
At that time, I was like, read the Bible. Like, I've read the Bible my whole life, but specifically, I like... the whole aspect of Jesus being transported to the desert, you know?
Yeah.
And the essential nature of his conversation with the devil.
Yep.
It's essential. And just realizing that I was holding the devil in my hand while I was fucking reading about it. It's like, if I was in the desert right now, there's a bunch of avocados here though. But if this was the desert, who is the devil? You know? And I've like realized I was looking at him, this can in my hand.
Yeah.
Some people will end there. They'll stop themselves there. And some people will use that as fuel, man, to fucking transform. I think with you, and that's what I saw, that aspect of transformation. And I'm a teacher now. I show people how to not get into shit at all levels. We just did this class for some pretty high level people this year. People that are involved in shit that is way over my pay grade and my experience base, but they're doing incredible things. And what surprised them about what I was showing them that they didn't know was the experience base behind it. Yeah. And I realized in that moment, like, dude, there's no way you can do any of this shit without fucking putting your hand in the blender. And I think that's Odin hanging from the tree. You know, that's Jesus going to the desert and speaking to the devil. You know, that there's a price to it. And not many pay that fucking price, which is, you know, that's why there's not a lot of weirdos out there that have a cool ass gym where forming these methodical fucking people that take apart other people in a ring setting, man. That was it, it's it was one of the coolest things that I got to experience this year, man. Witnessing you as a teacher.
Thanks, bro.
And also witnessing you with your team of teachers, because you're like a general, man. Like, you have these people around
you. We got
a
squad.
It's very impressive. It's very impressive.
For people that want to find out a little bit more about you, what you do, your gym, can you tell us a little bit about where they can find you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the gym is High Altitude Martial Arts. We're in Denver, Colorado. I don't have anything to do with that social media. My wife and some others run it. They do a good job. I would say follow me on social, but man, I just post pictures of my kids and shit. Like, you know what I mean? I'm not real good at...
If somebody has that in their head,
yeah,
you know, they're young... And we have a few kids like that. We call them kids. They're in their 20s. One of them right now, his name's Santi. Shout out to Santi. He's making his way up through the MMA ranks here in Mexico. Fucking
awesome
monster of a kid, the juggernaut. If somebody like that is around, you know, and they're looking at this as a career path for themselves, it is unforgiving. Not many people make it through the amount of people that make it to the other side of it. Like, what's your best advice for somebody like that?
When you're in your career, especially at the beginning, you think it's going to last forever. It's not. It is a window in time, right? It's a short window, and you got to make the best of it. So if you choose this, you got to be all in, right? Like, I see people they're like 1 foot in, 1 foot out, and they're just wasting their fucking time. Their career is going to be over at the same pace as the other guy. They're just not going to have anything to show for it afterwards. Right. So, make good choices, man. You know, do that Pello test every night. Did the choices you made today get you closer or further away from that goal? And be really intentional about what that goal is. If you got to uproot your whole life, like, a fighter has to be selfish. A fighter is inherently selfish, right? You better put yourself in the best room you can find. You have 100% control over who you pick as your training partners and your coaches. But once you pick them, you need to surrender a little bit and you know, listen to your coaches, listen to your training partners, that kind of thing. Because, you know, the thing that makes you want to be a fighter also makes you want to argue and be combative. And there's a lot, you know, a lot of us end up getting in our own way. I know I did. So I say, that's what I say, right? Like, make some good choices and then, you know, surrender control a little bit and, you know, get to work. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Cody, it was a fucking great conversation. We're going to have you back probably.
Cool.
We'll figure it out. We'll talk. We'll nerd out more on the next episode.
We'll
talk
about a remote one in Denver.
All right. Yeah, we can do a remote one in Denver. We just can't film the killers he's preparing because then they'll learn the secrets.
When are you guys are you guys coming out to Denver?
Yeah.
Soon. We might be going out there class.
Yeah, dude. I nerd out on all the same shit you do, like your hammer fucking war. We can't talk about, dude, we're at the end of the conversation. Warhammers and shit, like, we'll nerd out next time.
Cool.
Cody, thank you so much for coming out, brother. All right, see you next time.